Welcome to Ovarian Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Thomas Herzog, and to demonstrate some of the key management issues undergoing change in the field, he presented cases from his practice, beginning with one of the greatest challenges in clinical medicine, a patient who is also a physician.
This is a 44-year-old who presented with fairly large volume disease and had ascites and pelvic mass, a mental cake. We went and took her to the operating room, and she was found to have grade 3 papillary serous adenocarcinoma. We were able to optimally cytoreduce her. She did have a little bit of gross residual, just some fine miliary stuff sort of along the bowel surface, but not a whole lot else, nothing any larger than that. So I saw her in consultation afterwards, and the thing that gets tricky is that she's a physician herself, not in the oncology world, but obviously is deft enough to read the literature and was concerned about the usual outcome, if you will, in that there's a high response rate initially, but yet so many patients recur out of those that even respond to frontline therapy. And she said, look, I want to be around. I want to be aggressive. She's got a couple little kids. She has a practice. She's in by herself, unfortunately, which presents some interesting problems in terms of minimizing time away from the office and so forth. So it was an interesting discussion that we had, and it made me think about a lot of the issues more carefully and critically in terms of what we ask of our patients. And I think that with the new data coming out at ASCO, this all occurred in the last 3 to 4 weeks, and I knew what the results were. Everyone knew that arm 3 was going to be the winning arm.
You're talking about the bevacizumab study that was presented at the plenary session.
Right, I'm talking about GOG-218. Certainly that was on the table because we knew that the third arm with receiving Bev during chemotherapy as well as in a maintenance setting conferred an improved progression-free survival. We also, of course, had, if you want to be aggressive, the intraperitoneal data, and she was an ideal candidate for intraperitoneal therapy. And so we sort of went back and forth on it. As it turns out, she's chosen to do the intraperitoneal chemotherapy and wants to try at least several cycles of it, and then is considering adding Bev in maintenance when she's done. Now, obviously, there's not a lot of phase 3 data that supports that. There's none that supports that. There is some data coming out from Memorial that should be out shortly, looking at their experience with intraperitoneal and bevacizumab together. But other than that, I'm not aware of any data that's out there.
That's more safety though, right?
I think safety is a big issue, and I think, you know, just the overall toxicity are really considerations as well as quality of life that need to be taken into account. Obviously, we also want to keep her as functional as we can during treatment. And that becomes problematic as well when she wants to be super aggressive because there is a bit of a trade-off in terms of aggressiveness and toxicity that we've seen.
Are there any ongoing trials that theoretically she might be eligible for?
There's a couple of things I've talked to her about, both GOG and outside GOG. Most of the trials outside GOG are actually looking at incorporating other anti-angiogenic agents in the maintenance phase. So there's a pazopanib trial, and there's a trial that just closed, actually, with sorafenib. So, you know, there were certainly some options in that respect as well, and I always talk about trials to patients, but she was not interested in doing a clinical trial.
Now, have you decided what you're going to do at this point, or where is she right now?
Yeah, she received her first cycle of intraperitoneal chemotherapy, and as I said, she wants to see how she gets through at least several cycles and then is considering either switching over to IV and then finishing out with maintenance Bev, of which, as I said, there's limited data.
So it is a tricky situation when you have a very well-educated patient like this. I mean, would you give her maintenance Bev outside a protocol setting after either intraperitoneal or, for that matter, regular chemo?
Well, I think you certainly would consider doing that based on the results now. And we don't have any survival data based on that study in terms of overall survival, but you do have the PFS data, which was the primary endpoint of the study, that shows a difference. So, yeah, I would consider treating her with Bev outside of a trial setting now that we have that data publicly available.
Can you talk a little bit about how you approach the use of intraperitoneal therapy and the kinds of problems that you run into?
Well, Neil, I think the biggest thing is trying to get the patients through the therapy and getting them through the therapy without majorly distorting the schedule in doses that were provided in GOG-172. And I think that I'm a bit of a purist in that I'm very concerned that a lot of people have made some major adaptions to the therapy that was used in GOG-172, in which you saw almost a 17-month advantage in survival, overall survival, which is a very large difference. Having said that, the dose of the intraperitoneal cisplatin that was used was 100 milligrams per meter squared, and a number of people have dropped that dose down to 75 milligrams per meter squared. I agree that it's much better tolerated. I have had some problems with patients getting 100, but I've also had a number of patients with good performance status who were able to tolerate the protocol dose and schedule that was used. We also see people drop the day 8 paclitaxel that's used in the intraperitoneal setting as well. We also have seen some substitutions of the taxane using docetaxel or even ABI-007. So a number of different ways that one can change that therapy. The problem is we don't have any efficacy data that says that it's safe to do so. And that's my real concern. So what I usually do is start them on a regimen that's pretty close to GOG-172. I do admit that I shortened the paclitaxel infusion from 24 hours to 3 hours just as a matter of convenience. But other than that, I try to keep them on something that looks like GOG-172. And after that first or second cycle, I then reconsider in terms of how they're doing. And if they are not tolerating it, then I'm willing to drop the dose because they've forced my hand. But if they otherwise would have tolerated the therapy well, I'm very concerned that when we trade off 20 to 30% of the dose that they've received, that's a significant change. And it may be in part why we see the improvement in survival from that study. So it's really a trade-off in terms of the toxicity and trying to do something that doesn't look all that different from GOG-172. The other thing that needs to be considered is that probably the most important thing is choosing the right patient. So if you choose a patient that is with significant comorbidities, she has an impaired performance status, she's very elderly, those are patients who I think are going to have a very difficult time getting through intraperitoneal chemotherapy. And I certainly consider that. And I think we've all learned over the last 10 years since the inception of 172 that it really is important to choose your patients wisely. And I think that with better patient choice, you can avoid a lot of the toxicities that were reported originally.
Any clinical pearls in terms of supportive care of these patients? I've heard people say that hydration is particularly important. Any sort of things that you do that you think maybe are particularly helpful?
Yeah, I think hydration is vitally important, and have had one patient and seen reports of others where there has been severe renal damage if these patients are not adequately hydrated. So that's extremely key. It's also important to understand that just while they're in the hospital, we have pretty good control over their hydration. But these patients need to be instructed that if they go home and they're not tolerating PO well, that's an emergency. They need to call us immediately. It's not something where they can sit on it for 24 hours and then give us a call. Normally, you could. In fact, we deal with that all the time where somebody isn't tolerating liquids for 24 hours and we tell them to call us if it's been more than 24 hours. But in this case, that's not possible without some significant possible long-term sequela with the kidneys. We also use growth factors pretty liberally in terms of white blood cell support for these patients. I think that certainly their rate of febrile neutropenia warrants consideration in all these patients receiving prophylactic growth factors. It doesn't mean that it would be wrong not to, but certainly their rate of febrile neutropenia is such that it is not unreasonable to offer them growth factors prophylactically based on NCCN guidelines.
You know, people can look at the data out there, try to come up with some numbers, but also there's sort of clinical experience. And I'm curious what you would say to a patient, for example, like this one who is contemplating IP therapy, who says to you, what's the chance I'm going to just sail right through this, almost no problems? What's the chance I'm going to have some problems, but you know I'll be able to get through it without any really big deal? And what's the chance I'm going to really have a difficult time here?
Yeah. Well, It's a little simplistic, but in my experience, it's almost thirds. There's about a third of the patients that seem to fly through this without any problems. Then it's probably a little more than a third, frankly, that I would say maybe 50% that have some problems in terms of toxicity, but nothing that really is so overwhelming that it majorly alters our course in terms of continuing with treatment. And then there's probably 20% or so who just really don't do well at all with this. But I'd say it is about 20% that where we really have to not only take them off the intraperitoneal because they're just getting tired of it and they're feeling beat up, but rather that there's some significant problems that we've really tried to overcome that we were unsuccessful.
You mentioned the issue of selection of patients for IP therapy and potential problems with older patients with comorbidities. What are the guidelines that you have yourself about, is there an age cutoff or generally who you'll bring this up to or recommend it to?
Yeah. You know, I don't have an absolute age cutoff. It's one of those things where I do look at biologic age and not only chronologic age. Having said that, I can't think of too many patients where I've done intraperitoneal over the age of 75, and I can't think of any over the age of 80. That doesn't mean that the next patient that comes in who looks like she's in great shape and wants to try it and can win the argument with me, I wouldn't give it a try. But in general, I just think that the renal sufficiency and everything else starts to become an issue when you get over 80.
Now, my impression, although we haven't actually studied this, is that intraperitoneal therapy is not commonly utilized in a community-based setting. Is that your impression? If so, why?
Absolutely. The uptake of intraperitoneal chemotherapy, I think, has been very interesting in the sense that you would expect that there would be greater uptake based on the size of the difference in survival that's seen between the two arms and the fact that you have three phase three trials. The problem, though, is that each of those trials has some major criticisms. And one of the major criticisms is that you're giving a substantially greater amount of drug in the intraperitoneal cohort than you are in the intravenous cohort. So we've never really fairly compared dose for dose with a contemporary control arm the difference between just route of delivery. By far the most fair comparison was Dave Albert's study, the original study that got all this going, and that was looking at cisplatin and Cytoxan versus an intraperitoneal cis and Cytoxan. And those were equal doses, and they still showed an advantage in the intraperitoneal route. The criticism of that was, well, you didn't use a control arm that's relative to today's patient, that being with a taxane. There were also concerns in terms of the fact of statistically they kept the arm open longer than what the original protocol allowed for, to allow for a difference, if you will. So there were several criticisms of that trial, some of which I think are valid, some not completely valid. But nonetheless, people dismissed that trial. Then there was the Markman trial, GOG-114, that was a very strange trial in that they gave a dose of carboplatin with an AUC of 9 IV in the intraperitoneal arm, but not in the intravenous arm. And so this was in some form a chemical debulking, if you will, and some people thought that that may be the advantage that's seen, and this in no way says that intraperitoneal therapy is better. And then, of course, I think that the trial that's most relevant is Deb Armstrong's GOG-172 that we've been speaking of. But even there, you're giving 20 to 30% more platinum and taxane in the intraperitoneal arm, and so that's a significant difference. And indeed, the grade 3, grade 4 toxicities were significantly greater in the intraperitoneal arm. And if you're counter-arguing that, though, you'd say quality of life wasn't significantly different at 12 months. So most of those toxicities didn't appear to be all that different, although I'm not so sure we're great at measuring toxicities in quality of life tools at this point. As a piece of evidence for that, the grade 3, 4 neuropathy in the intraperitoneal arm was 19%. That's a pretty whopping neuropathy, a very clinically significant neuropathy. I mean, that is a degree that not only affects activities of daily living, but it'll get you daily compliance. And yet, we didn't show any difference in quality of life at 12 months. So is it a statistical issue? Is it a fact that we're not sensitive enough to pick up these differences? That's what we don't know. But I think all these things need to be considered. as it's broken down, you know, we really have two camps. One camp saying that everyone should be offered intraperitoneal chemotherapy who's optimally cytoreduced, who's a good candidate based on morbidity and age. And then we have another group that says if you did this with the right control arm, that being carboplatin and paclitaxel, there may be a slight difference, but that difference isn't worth all the effort, toxicity, catheter complications, and everything else that someone has to go through. Personally, I err on the side of the fact that 17 months difference in overall survival is quite sizable, and I do think that patients should consider this option in more cases than what's currently being used in the community.
Now, you mentioned GOG 218, the plenary presentation. And without going into all the details, because Bob Berger actually is on the same program you're on, I am curious about your take, because actually just based on what you just said, it sounds like you're more towards the proactive end of the spectrum. Certainly, I don't think too many people are talking about using Bev after IP therapy off study. Doesn't make it wrong, but I'm just pointing that out for the sake of balance. And I don't get the feeling that many people are actually ready to jump on board in terms of using it off study, assuming they can get it paid for with IV therapy, and I could be wrong about that. What's your take on the data?
First of all, let me say that I would not routinely offer this to someone with IP therapy either, and I hope I made that clear, that this was a bit of a unique situation in which a physician was doing a little bit of her own design, if you will, and certainly it was a conversation at a high level in terms of what the advantages and disadvantages would be of doing that. Now, the second issue is something that I think is much more problematic, and that is if you have a patient that fits the study criteria that was used and they're now being looked at for frontline therapy, or they're just coming off frontline therapy, would you then give that 15 months, up to 15 months of exposure to bevacizumab? And that I find very problematic, and I don't know what the right answer is. I don't think it's the standard of care at this point. I think that that's fair to say. Is it a standard of care? Is it a potential option that's reasonable? And I think it is, based on the safety data that we've seen and the fact that there was an improvement in the primary endpoint. As you know, the median progression-free survival with the control arm was 10.3 months, and it went up to 14.1 months with the experimental arm, where they received the Bev with chemo as well as in the maintenance setting. You know, would I have liked to seen a bigger difference in PFS? Yes, I would have. However, when you look at the hazard ratio, because this was a worse patient population than what you would expect, you really saw that the hazard ratio looks pretty good, and in fact is on par with adding or substituting cyclophosphamide with paclitaxel. You know, it's a pretty good jump in terms of what we see there. The con side of really advocating for incorporating Bev, in my mind, is the fact that the survival data isn't there yet to support that. So if we had even a strong trend towards an improved survival, then I think I would be much more in favor of more commonly offering this to patients. And so I really think that before this becomes what people would consider the standard of care, we need to see mature survival data from GOG 218. I also think ICON 7, which is another trial looking at Bev with a lower dose and a little bit lower exposure time, 12 months, will also provide some clearer answers as to whether there's a survival advantage.
Now, up until this point, in what situations, if any, have you been using Bev off study with ovarian cancer, and what's your experience been?
I've not been using it up front. I've been using it in the recurrent setting. And I have sometimes been combining it with chemo, but frankly, I've been using it more as a single agent. It's just a little bit cleaner to tell what's going on. It's so difficult when you combine it with another cytotoxic, because at that point, you don't know where your efficacy is coming from. You can sort of separate out the toxicity profiles, I think, at least rudimentarily, because we think we understand what the different drugs and this particular agent cause in terms of toxicity. But in terms of efficacy, I have no idea what's working. So I know there's been Bev with probably every agent you can name in terms of some form of a phase one or phase two abstract at ASCO over the last 5 years. But I don't really know what that means. So I've been using it more as a single agent. It works excellently on patients with ascites. Those are ideal patients. And I've been using it generally treating the progression in those circumstances. And funding has been easier and easier, I have found. At least here in New York, we've not had near the number of problems that we did, say, 2 years ago when we first started using it. And back then, it seemed like I was writing a letter every week. And now it's been some time since I've had to write a letter.
Let's talk about your 58-year-old woman.
She presented last year and was optimally cytoreduced. And interestingly, I believe she had no gross residual, but did have a grade 3 tumor with lots of tumor, fairly widely disseminated. And she received carboplatin and paclitaxel for 6 cycles. I had her CA-125 normalize after, I believe, it was the 5th cycle. So she had a good response, but it wasn't a perfect response in the fact that it took some time for her CA-125 to normalize. As I recall, I don't believe it even got below 10. I think her nadir was 14, as I think about it now. So we've been following her, and when we saw her 3 months later, her CA-125 had gone up to 28. So we rechecked it a month later, and it had gone up to 84. We got a CT scan that showed small volume multifocal disease. So we're at the juncture now of deciding how we would want to treat her. And the biggest issue really now is that of the fact that the one piece of data I didn't include is that she does have a strong family history. A sister that had breast cancer at the age of 37, and her mother had ovarian cancer. So we went ahead and did testing for BRCA, and she was indeed positive for BRCA1, which is certainly, I think, interesting in terms of, you know, a lot of what's going on right now in terms of possible therapies. So having said this, and maybe I can learn something from the community here as well, but I've had a hard time getting patients such as this exposure to PARP inhibitors. And so certainly this would be a strong consideration for this type of patient. There's a number of PARP inhibitors that are under development, as you know, and certainly the fact that there have been results that have come out in ASCO the last 2 years looking at a number of trials with PARP inhibitors that look extremely promising, including some of the trials this year that I think were quite impressive. So what we're doing is checking right now to see what the availability of a PARP inhibitor is. As I said, this was a very recent case just in the last week, so that's currently what I'm doing right now to see if there's any open trial that we can get her on or if, in fact, we can perhaps get it off trial, which heretofore I've not been able to do.
What about if there is no PARP inhibitor? How would you think through her therapy, and how do you approach, in general, the management of recurrent disease?
Well, she would be considered platinum resistant based on the time frame from which she's recurred. So we break these patients into 0 to 6 and then greater than 6 months for platinum resistant versus platinum sensitive. So 0 to 6, platinum resistant, greater than 6, platinum sensitive. So she falls into the category of platinum resistant disease. Generally, we use single agent therapy in the setting. The most common drug that's used in the United States, and certainly probably in my practice in the setting as well because of convenience, is pegylated liposomal doxorubicin. It certainly has a very good schedule with being given every 4 weeks and a pretty reasonable toxicity profile. So that certainly would be a reasonable option for her. Alternatively, topotecan would be a reasonable option. And certainly there's issues of whether you would give this with the FDA-approved schedule of daily times 5 or whether you would use weekly therapy. Most people have gone to weekly therapy in terms of toxicity. And then, of course, you could consider weekly taxanes, which I think are also very effective. VP16 is also something that is appealing. Docetaxel is also something that has been shown to have very good efficacy. And then she would be a candidate also for bevacizumab.
Did you mention gemcitabine?
Gemcitabine would also be an agent that one could use. Now, this is not FDA approved in this slot. And frankly, I don't use it a whole lot as a single agent in this setting because I use a lot of it in patients who recur in the platinum-sensitive setting in combination with platinum. If she had never seen gemcitabine, I would certainly consider using gemcitabine. What I often do, though, is treat with a single agent at this point and see how she does and even sequence the single agents. And if she does respond, great. And then what I often do if she recurs is come back with platinum and gem in combination, even though she's platinum resistant. And so I try to extend that out a little bit.
As long as you're talking about your algorithms for recurrent disease, then how do you approach the patient who has platinum-sensitive disease?
Well, platinum-sensitive disease, I tend to break up into two groups, and I stratify them by whether they're symptomatic or not. And the original split, if you will, is between 6 and 12 months and greater than 12 months. And that's a little bit artificial. It doesn't mean that someone in 11 months I wouldn't consider more like the group that's greater than 12 months. But I look at the 6 to 12-month group slightly differently. And that is that, for lack of a better word, I consider them to be intermediately platinum sensitive. In other words, if you look at the breakdown, this is a continuous variable, and this whole concept was one based on retrospective data in which they found that the subsequent response to re-exposure to platinum continued to go up with the increase in the duration since the time the patient had received platinum. And so for me, someone who's 6.5 months out isn't going to behave very differently than someone who's platinum resistant. And so if she has absolutely no symptoms at that point, to me, it doesn't make a lot of sense to come back with the big guns right at that point. I try to reserve those for later on. And there's certainly room for disagreement in doing it that way, but I find that it works quite well in my practice. And so if I have a patient who's fairly asymptomatic, has small volume disease, I will tend to treat her with very much like a platinum-resistant patient in that 6 to 9 month window at least, and maybe even up to 12 months, but less likely. And then if I have a patient that is out over that or is symptomatic, even at 6 or 7 months, then I think it's important to try to invoke the very best and active agents that we have available, because you need to get her into remission quickly because of her symptomatology.
What about the patient who's beyond a year? How do you decide between the various choices?
Right. Well, once again, so if I have a patient who's in that late 6 to 12 month interval or symptomatic anytime through, or greater than a year, then I usually go to a platinum-based regimen. The two most common choices, for FDA-approved anyway, are platinum and paclitaxel, or platinum and gemcitabine. So those are the two approved. Now, having said that, we have some very interesting data that was originally presented last year at ASCO, known as the Calypso trial, that looked at platinum and pegylated liposomal doxorubicin, in which, frankly, I was surprised that we actually saw an improvement in PFS with the pegylated liposomal doxorubicin arm over the paclitaxel arm. And I think a lot of people thought that they might be the same, but I don't think anyone expected one to be statistically superior to the other. And indeed, the toxicity profiles were different. Hypersensitivity reactions were far less in the pegylated liposomal doxorubicin arm. So I think this has to be a third option, although I'm always a little concerned when you're trying to do any change in practice off of one phase 3 trial. But it was a phase 3 trial. It was a cooperative group trial that was done in Europe by a group that I think does very good work. And so I think that certainly you need to consider this option as well now, even though this is not FDA approved. So what I do, to me, it makes more sense to treat a patient certainly under 18 months with something other than a taxane again, because they've just received 6 cycles of a taxane. We know that we can likely substitute these drugs freely in terms of not compromising efficacy. And we now have a different toxicity profile. And so being able to do that with a different toxicity profile and having the added benefit of perhaps a different mechanism of action and the hope that now maybe you'll overcome whatever resistance was present compels me to use platinum and gem most commonly, and now to even consider platinum and pegylated liposomal doxorubicin.
What is your experience in terms of side effects and toxicity tolerability with those two combinations, platinum with gem and platinum with liposomal doxorubicin?
Pretty well tolerated in general. I think the biggest problem with the platinum and gem is the day 8 dosing. And certainly that to me has been the hardest part, being able to stay on schedule and dose with that. I would say probably almost half my patients require some dose reduction on the day 8 dose. So that's been a little bit of a problem. But it's one of those regimens that once you get to the right dose, you don't see a big continuation of the nadiring that goes on. It's a little bit like topotecan in that respect. If you get to the right dose for the patient, they seem to tolerate it pretty well. The pegylated liposomal doxorubicin with platinum, I don't have a lot of experience in. I've treated probably 10 or 15 patients with it, but not to the same degree of, you know, over hundreds that I've treated with platinum and gem. So I think that that remains to be seen. There is surprisingly a fair amount of myelosuppression with that regimen still, and so you need to be mindful of that. But outside of that, it's pretty well tolerated, and patients certainly like the Q4-week schedule, which it's important to point out it was used in the Calypso.
How about the hand-foot syndrome?
Anything under 50 tends not to have a real big problem, and certainly when they combine it with platinum, it's significantly lower than that, and haven't seen the same problems with it. It's certainly, you know, not to say that it doesn't exist, but it's certainly under 20% where you see significant problems.
Okay, let's talk about your last patient, the 61-year-old woman.
I had a 61-year-old who also presented pretty typically with large volume disease and ascites, and she was actually suboptimally cytoreduced. She had a lot of disease at the root of the mesentery, and we were able to get all large volume tumor down, but I would say she had residuals, you know, of up to 2 centimeters or so here and there. But she responded beautifully to frontline chemotherapy. She also received carboplatinum and paclitaxel for 6 cycles. She nadired very well. She had a CA-125 that went down to 8. It took 4 cycles for her to get there and was doing very well until her 6-month checkup, at which time her CA-125 went from 8 up to 36. And so, of course, that's a very long patient visit in terms of we use it as a carrot getting through therapy, and now you have an increase. The patient wants to know why. You say, well, it's just barely outside the normal and so forth, but certainly is very concerning. So we rechecked it several weeks later, and indeed, it went up even further. I believe it was 72 with the next check. And after that, we went ahead and got a CT scan, which showed absolutely nothing. So we didn't see anything on the CT scan that looked to be problematic at all. So we rechecked the value a month later, and it had gone to 105. So we know this value is going up. The only thing reassuring about the value going up is that the rate of change has not been all that great in the last check. It didn't go up by the same amount. It didn't double or anything like that as it had been. But this is extremely concerning, Neil, and the fact is that you know and I know and likely the patient knows that this is an early harbinger of recurrent disease. What we don't know is whether there's any benefit to treating her, and in fact, if we look at Gordon Rustin's data that was the plenary presentation last year at ASCO, a very compelling study that said don't treat her at this point. In fact, you'll end up giving her more chemo, a worse quality of life, and you're not going to provide a single iota of a benefit in terms of survival for her overall. It's a very difficult sell for our patients.
I mean, I guess the thing that he brought up was not only don't treat her, but don't even draw it, which I guess is pretty hard to do.
That's absolutely right. And so this is a conversation that we've been having with our patients in the surveillance setting now after frontline therapy to say, you know, there is a study out there. You should be aware of it. There are those who advocate not checking it. Are you comfortable doing that? And I have not had but 3 patients do that. Everyone else was absolutely not. I want to know what my value is. I don't believe that not treating earlier wouldn't make a difference, even though you take them through the data. So at least in New York City, it's been a difficult sell, as you might imagine, to try to convince patients that a significant piece of data that we used during their prognostication as well as during their treatment for response to treatment criteria is no longer important in the surveillance setting.
So what happened with this lady?
Well, we ordered a PET CT on her now. So what I try to do in these cases is stretch things out as much as I can, because I do agree that there's no benefit to immediately jumping on therapy in someone who's asymptomatic, doesn't have anything on scan. So I try not to treat them. And indeed, that's what I'm doing. So what I said was, look, we don't want to get these scans too close together. So I'm trying to get another CT scan, and she was willing to not be treated if we combined it with a PET scan 2 months after the last one. So we're going to wait for that to occur and see if anything lights up.
So I take it she's not completely comfortable being not treated?
That's correct.
Yeah, I can
understand
that. She's
not comfortable at all not being treated. And I think that, you know, if you talk to other physicians, many of them will tell you the same thing. I have had some, though, say they've been more successful in having patients not follow their CA125 values, but that has not been the norm in talking to the majority of physicians.
You know, in a way, it kind of reminds me a little bit of PSA-only relapse in prostate cancer. And one of the things that's been discussed there is using that as a window to study novel biologics that maybe won't make the patient that sick. Anything that's available with ovarian cancer that maybe she could be eligible to receive?
Yeah, that's a great concept that's actually been exploited. There was a study from the GOG, I believe GOG-198, that looked at thalidomide versus tamoxifen. And the thought was thalidomide's anti-angiogenic activity may provide a benefit. Surprisingly, the tamoxifen looked more favorable. So I think it's a nice cue to look at these patients and try to get some idea as to whether we could prevent these recurrences. We know currently that when the CA125 level doubles over its upper limit of normal, that we have about 90 days before we usually see something on imaging study.
If you were going to treat this woman at this point, what do you think it might be with?
I think I would consider using tamoxifen on her, because at this point I don't have any idea that any cytotoxic is going to provide her any survival advantage, and it may be just a bullet that I'm firing into the air that I won't be able to use later on when we need it.
Have you seen or have objective responses been reported with tamoxifen?
We have. I've seen more in my personal experience of just some stabilization, and I haven't seen long stabilization, so I can't tell whether that's just the fact that the CA125 stops going up as rapidly and would have done the same without intervention or not. But I have seen a couple of patients have their CA125 stabilized to maybe some slight decrease. I haven't seen anybody in my practice who's gone, for example, in this case, over 100 down to under 20.